Good evening. Couple of weeks ago, I talked to t touched on vow as I was talking about Tsutsugi Roshi's expression of her inmost request, and tonight I wanted to talk a little more about vow and its role in the Zen tradition and how it relates to our practice a little bit, and through a story I wanted to share. That's been rereading parts of Shohaku Okumura's book, Living by Vow. Came out maybe 12 years ago or so. He's talking about some of our chants, including the Bodhisattva vows, which we'll chant at the end of this talk. And as a central piece, which I've shared before, this saying that sentient beings are those who are driven by karma, and bodhisattvas are those who are guided by vow. So it's encouraging us to live by vow and to explore what that means. In the book, he retells a story from the Jataka tales, which are these collection of tales from in the Pali Canon that supposedly portrays the Buddha's past lives, what his lives were like before becoming Buddha Shakyamuni. So in this one, which is many eons ago, he was a Brahmin by the name of Sumedha, who lived in the town of Amaravati. There's some parallels to his background, the background of Shakyamuni Buddha and Sumedha, as Sumedha was the son of a wealthy noble family, just like the Buddha. And perhaps like just like the Buddha lost his birth mother in his first week of being alive, Sumedha lost both his parents too early. And as he did, he inherited these huge treasures of gold, silver, gems, and pearls that had been accumulated through 7 generations, as the story goes. In his grief, he realized that none of this wealth could really bring him happiness and bring his parents back. And so he, a moment of inspiration, gave it all away to pursue the simple life devoted to spiritual practices. He went up to the Himalayas to practice as a hermit, and was quite gifted in these practices, and supposedly attained these superhuman powers, superhuman knowledge, and supernatural powers during his practice. Eventually, he learned that some distance away was going to be a visit from the Buddha of this eon, which is Dipankara Buddha. So Sumedha used his natural powers of flight to transport himself to that place to see the Buddha. As he arrived, the road on which the Buddha was supposed to travel to arrive had been flooded, so he volunteered to fill it with soil. And instead of continuing to use his supernatural powers, he decided that as a special offering, he would do all this work by hand. So he began diligently moving dirt. Now, he was not able to complete this work before Dipankara Buddha arrived. And so Sumedha put down his shovel and just spread out his thick long hair and just stretched his body, out to make a plank and ask the Buddha to to walk across, invited him. So this is when we prostrate, we lower ourselves to the ground, place both knees, both elbows and the forehead to the ground, and then gently lifting our palms upwards, as if we're lifting the Buddha. Similar kind of expression. In the story, as the Buddha walks over Sumedha, his prostrated body, he sort of glided weightlessly. So wasn't pushing him further down into the mud. But Sumedha in that moment had a sudden realization, where he realized that what a great deal of trouble the Buddha was going to share the Dharma with other people, and that he was doing it for their happiness and well-being. And so then in that moment, he abandoned his earlier intention, which has been just to simply escape the round of samsara, birth and death, practicing for his own benefit merely, and aspired instead to become a Buddha and to remain in the cycle of samsara to help sentient beings. And just as he had this aspiration arise, we talk about bodhicitta, the aspiration to live for the benefit of all. Dipankara Buddha could sense this, his vow that arose right there, Sumedha's. And so he gave him, was traditional in some of these sutras and stories, the prediction that all bodhisattvas have received from previous Buddhas, which is to say that, said, I see Sumedha that in the future will be a Buddha called Gautama. And so he gave Sumedha the confidence that his vow would be realized. And after this encounter, the story doesn't really go into what sort of teachings Dipankara Buddha may have offered. That seems to beside the point. After making this vow, Sumedha realized he needed to practice the six perfections and went ahead and continued practice. And then many eons later, he was reborn as Shakyamuni Gautama and realized awakening. But we're not 2,500 years, you know, or so ago from now. And this is the world, the eon we're living in. So just a few points wanted to make or reflect upon in this story and then bring it up for any discussion. And the first is Sumedha's decision to use his own hands rather than the most more expedient supernatural powers that he was supposedly imbued with in order to prepare the road for the Buddha. So this is what we call, I think, samu, work practice in Zen. And what we mean is that work doesn't just have to be about getting things done. It's also about the mind with which that work is carried out. It's about honoring the task at hand. And, work can, in fact, be a complete expression of our practice, of our intentions, of our vows. Physical labor does not need to be menial. And in Zen, understanding of the way is actually realized through the actions of our bodies, speech, and mind. We see this too when Dipankara Buddha arrives and Sumedha prostrates himself in the mud. Just reading this sort of literally, it may seem maybe a little much. What what's so great about letting somebody walk over you? But a prostration, lowering oneself to the ground in this way, is also an expression of humility. Our Muslim neighbors across the hall here to practice a very similar practice and meet over here every Friday to prostrate, essentially. Up until the Buddha arrived, Sumedha had been practicing for himself, but at that moment, something about the Buddha inspired him immediately to let go of this limited idea. Made him realize that what he had held to be true up until that point was incomplete and one-sided. And so he throws himself to the ground in the realization that there's more, something more worthwhile to pursue than what he had previously imagined. Think another way to think about this expression is, in more general terms, as something that may seem like a sacrifice or an inconvenience, but is also like totally worth it, and just, yeah, in fact, not a sacrifice. But what sort of lengths, efforts are we willing to make, and inconveniences we're willing to endure in order to express our values, aspirations, our desires for the world. What might such a true expression look like in this day and time? Of not putting ourselves and our own needs first, but being sensitive to those around us. And setting, possibly, setting the bar higher than what we can possibly achieve, right? In this lifetime, at least, and yet, but just setting a not letting that deter us, not letting ourselves be limited to what seems realistic or not, but to just aspire to live our values as fully as we can, and then go on from there. Another's, in a way, like our practice of zazen too, is also sort of an inconvenience, or isn't the most comfortable thing, perhaps to do with our bodies. So we were reading Suzuki Roshi's chapter last week. It may not feel natural to sit upright and still for half an hour, balanced, mindful of our breathing and allowing ourselves to breathe fully into our torso and all the way down to our abdomen, tip of the head, crown pointing towards the ceiling, and the chin tucked. Placing our hands in the mudra and sitting silent and still as from our perspective of our karmic consciousness, it's not a natural and easeful either posture, but we make this posture in order to make, we sit like a Buddha in Zen. It's a ritual expression of of Buddha nature, of enlightenment. And so, we're letting our karmic self take the back seat and giving more space for our awakened nature to shine forth. The Buddha to fit into this deluded being's body, so to speak. And in Zen, I think the practice is much more about the body leading the mind than the mind leading the body. It starts with a physical expression of sorts a lot of the times. And so, and this last point I wanted to make is around the vow. So, in this, Asamita prostrates himself to the Buddha. He makes a vow, and it's impossible to keep promise or expression of aspiration. And so, these are central in the Zen tradition. And just, I'm saying, we usually start with the physical expression, but sometimes we start with we also let the verbal expression and the repetition of these vows sort of come first as we chant them ritually to sort of sow the seeds for these aspirations to grow and get stronger in some ways. When we chant. And so, most commonly, of course, as we chant, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them, so forth. Like, these are impossible from our own, limited standpoint right now. And so, there seems to be a great, how do we reconcile this distance between this being this ancient twisted karma and a Buddha. Their practice encourages us both to be to not sell ourselves short and to be humble as well. And the other aspect of vow is repentance, to acknowledge that we're still acting out our ancient twisted karma on a daily basis, and to not let that discourage us, be acknowledge that and be humble about our limitations, but not let that stop us. And so, most commonly in the Mahayana tradition, this sort of there's an encouragement of patience of saying, oh, the Buddha practiced for many eons, many, many, many lifetimes, and he's just sort of persisted. And was diligent lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, and then finally, encouraging us to have patience and to endure over time. And in Zen, some of the teachings, well, it's not sort of negating that, also place a little more emphasis on this kind of, instead of making this a linear practice. It's like right here and right now is the opportunity for practice, and Dogen's teachings on practice realizations encourages us to just manifest Buddha-like qualities right here and right now, where we are, to practice wholeheartedly, and that is already the expression of realization. And in fact, coming back to the story of Sumedha, in a way, his expression of just putting himself wholeheartedly into rebuilding this flooded road or just prostrating himself in front of the Buddha is maybe seen as like that is already bodhisattva practice. He's already realized his vow actually. In those actions, just his intellect comes afterwards, and then he realizes this on a cognitive level only once the Buddha arrives. But already before, he has already been engaging in such a way through his actions, already shifted from what can I get from this to like I'm wanting to serve. I'm inspired. I want to serve. So his physical expression precedes his intellectual understanding. And so I wanted to talk about vow a little bit because next month, in a little over a month, May 17th, after the half day sitting in May, we hope to have a Bodhisattva precepts ceremony, as Allison and Paula have been studying the 16 Bodhisattva precepts and have in this Zen way just patiently been engaging in the practice of putting one stitch after another, studying their own karmic consciousnesses like a Buddha would do, and sewing these stitches, taking refuge. This is a way, another way to, not unlike the practice of Sumedha, just making great vows that are impossible to completely keep, and yet just not letting that stop them, not letting the fact that it's been more sewing than either of them had expected stop them. So we'll have some time to celebrate their efforts and receiving of the precepts on the 17th. I hope you can join us the afternoon then for the first ceremony of its kind at Brattleboro Zen Center. And be the first time for these two bodhisattvas to receive these precepts, and the first time for me officiating the ceremony. Thank you very much.